Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host, and once again, thank you so much for joining in. Today we have a special guest, something we've never really done before. It's Dr. Sharad Paul. He is the author of The Genetics of Health. And what's so cool is how this ties into our podcast, talking about authenticity and being our best versions of our true self. His take is how we can hack our own genetic code to become the best version of ourselves. What does it mean to think about genetics and ourselves? How do we tie the way we're made, our blueprint, into how we live and become our truer self in our health, our life, our business? At first, I was kind of like, I've never really thought of it from this angle. After chatting with him, you can see why I enjoyed the show, and he's filled with so much information. He has MD, a master's in philosophy and law. He's just an incredibly educated and thoughtful guy. So check it out. Genetics of Health is the new book. Very, very, very interesting. You can find all the links on our website as usual. How our unique DNA means that we all respond differently to everyday things like food, exercise, work stress, even prescription drugs. Tune in. Let me know what you think. Thank you guys once again for listening. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. Thank you once again for joining us. Today we have Dr. Sharad Paul. He is a world-renowned geneticist and discovered how to tap into genes to figure out who we really are, what makes us tick, and how we can hack our own genetic codes to become the best version of ourselves. And so first of all, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to have you here because we've really never explored the conversation of authenticity, finding our best self, our true self in our life. We talk about that more from a philosophical, psychological perspective. But can you just open up the conversation by sharing with the audience a bit what you mean with these statements that the genetics to help us figure out who we really are, what makes us tick? What does that mean for people who haven't looked at this question of who we are from that perspective?
All right. I think the first thing is, you know, you mentioned the psychological aspects to creating a better self. And in some ways, it's not too different, except the genes just expresses of proteins. So in other words, the first thing I like to say on genetics is genes are our blueprints, but they're not our destiny. So, you know, we are actually in charge. So, for example, if you take a particular gene X, it will produce good proteins and it will produce bad proteins. And what you do can determine whether the protein is good or bad. So in some ways, we are actually really in control of our health and well-being, but we don't often realize it. So what my book does is it just looks at specific genes to do with, you know, physical fitness, exercise, cognitive function, brain function, eating and drinking. So you just learn how to be more attuned to your own body.
I love that. I love this. I feel like that's going to go on my wall. It's a blueprint, but it's not our destiny. But so if that's true, if we have this blueprint, but in fact, it doesn't have to be expressed unless under certain circumstances, what do you feel is the biggest misconception then for people in terms of the way they eat, the way they sleep, the way they live, and thinking that it, you know, there's so many things out there of everybody should be paleo, everybody should go low fat, right? Like there's these fads on how we eat, how we live, how we sleep. Everybody needs 8 hours of sleep. I've never felt that any of that is really true. I think we're all very different. What are your thoughts to these trends and fads of health?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Laura, because I think, you know, your show in some ways, you know, about being authentic is really encompasses what I'm about to say, because in everything you need to find you, you know, it's like one thing I do one day a week. I mean, as you know, I'm a medical doctor as well as I specialize in skin cancer. But one day a week, I teach creative writing to children who are in disadvantaged schools. And one of the things I find is, you know, if you teach somebody to write a story, effectively, you teach them to write their own story. And that's what helps with your problem solving, with your math and science. So let me give you an example. Say, for example, writing is all about the three C's. So you set the context, in other words, like you would call it defining your brand in modern speak, or you would say then develop the characters. So each of the characters you need to try and understand. And lastly, there will be conflicts which we resolve. And if you look at it in this perspective, I think this is a great parable for business, life, understanding yourself. So taking one step back, so let's just say a particular problem, something's happened, I'm operating on somebody, something's gone wrong. First thing people do, they don't deal with it properly because you take it all personally. And it affects your ego, you're wounded, you're angry, then you're frightened somebody's going to sue you. So the first thing is set the context. So you've got to say, okay, hang on, things happen, and this is how surgery is, and you've explained it to people, and now we've got a problem to solve. So what is the nature of the problem? So then you try and understand the character, and then you fix it. Then there are little conflicts, your version of events versus somebody else's, and you resolve it. But it doesn't have to be always personal or counterattacking or, what I mean? I do find world has become so reactive that we think we actually have a high energy state, but actually it's a very low energy state. So I was actually writing a little article, somebody bought John Keats, because your father was in healthcare, John Keats was the poet, was training to be a surgeon, and he quit surgery, he said, to save his soul. And I was telling this to medical students, and I said, it is because what he was talking about is what is called negative capability. So in other words, don't try and reconcile everything, but you just have to sometimes say it is what it is, accept both success and failure, and then see how you can keep improving. And that's really what authenticity is about.
Yes, yes, I agree with that. And in your book, The Genetics of Health, you explore eating for your gene types, going on this path of,
that's right,
specifically to us.
Yeah.
What does that mean? How can somebody do that? What is eating for a genetic type? What do you mean by that?
Okay. So exactly just like what we've been talking about, it's a version of genetic authenticity, if you like. So for example, let me give you an example. So let's just say coffee. Everybody reads a report in the newspaper, and one day it says coffee is terrible for you, and you meet people who say, don't touch it. And some people, then you read a report which says it's really good for you. So everyone's confused. So patients will often say, is coffee good or bad? Is vitamin C good, bad? So really the thing is, the part of the book on eating for your gene type is, so 50% of the population are fast metabolizers of caffeine and 50% are slow. So what it means is for 50% of people who metabolize caffeine quickly, caffeine, which is a drug in a way, is actually very, very useful because it reduces heart disease, does various things. But if you're a slow metabolizer, it could do the opposite if you increase your doses. So in other words, what may be good for someone else may not be good for you. And so I've developed a 21 gene test panel, which, if you just went sharadpaul.com or just did geneticsofhealth.com, you can order your own personal test. But if you look, another example which I found very interesting was vitamin C. So in evolution, we have a use it or lose it thing. So in other words, creatures which stopped eating vitamin C produce vitamin C, or creatures which never ate, rather, or people like human beings or gorillas or bats eat a lot of citrus fruit, we can't produce our own vitamin C. But here's what's interesting is 20% of the population, which is 1 in 5 of us, carry a version of the GSTT1 gene, which is non-functional. In other words, they cannot absorb vitamin C properly. So these people do not double their intake of vitamin C. It's as simple as eating an extra orange a day or an extra pepper or something. What you find is, these were studies done in people in their 20s, and this is how crazy it was. Per year, their waist circumference went up by a little 0.1 inch, their blood pressure went up 0.1, and their blood sugar went up. So these people, by the time they were 40s, 50s, they were overweight, they either had diabetes or pre-diabetes, or they had heart disease. And here's the crazy thing. Medicine typically picks these people up only at that stage because they've got an illness, something you can treat.
Yes.
So what I say, I wrote a blog about, and one of the things is, just eating an orange a day literally could have kept the doctor away for those people.
Right.
So this version of knowing your own gene self is sometimes certain diets for some people simply will not work for other people, because there may be a very simple explanation why it's not working, and it's as simple maybe as eating an orange for you.
And so the testing, for those of you out there who haven't heard of it, he has this Evolve 21 gene testing. And so it's something you can go on his website. I haven't done it just to fully disclose, but the idea of it, right, is that it'll help you figure out what is specific to you.
Absolutely. The first thing I must clarify, because we're talking about gene testing, I must briefly explain the different types out there because they're all different. So the one you hear most often in America is what we call the WGS, or the whole genome sequencing. And that's basically they do your entire gene map. Basically, there's a lot of gobbledygook because we don't really know what a lot of genes do.
Right.
And also we also test for diseases which there's no cure for. So I'm actually concerned about it because not only does it have insurance implications in a country like America, but also stress is a major factor of illness in our lives, of a cause of illness. So I think it's foolish to test for things we cannot do anything about. So I don't do that WGS. The second type of thing is the microbiota testing, which is like on feces and things to see what you can eat and tolerate. So what I've done is it's fundamentally slightly different. We just do exercise and food related. So in other words, you just learn to exercise and eat for your gene type. So for example, things we do like coffee, the vitamin C, folic acid, vitamin D, there's gluten, lactose, what kind of exercises are you more attuned, your body is more attuned for. So that kind of stuff. So really it helps you, if nothing else, it'll give you more energy, make you feel healthier. You know, if weight loss is a pattern, we can pick people. You mentioned the paleo. So I'll say, you know, the real paleo diet is a paleo fantasy, as I say in my book, because paleo man had a weed growing all around the world called purslane, or pigweed, which was so high in omega-3, which we don't have anymore growing anywhere. So really with that, they ate that and then they eat meat, but we're just eating the meat and thinking we're paleo. So it's really a fantasy.
Interesting. Yes. I've never heard that in all of the paleo blogging. You made a comment I just want to back up to, and you said stress is the major reason for most illness. I mean, people say this in America, Western medical, you know, they disagree, you know, pretty much full-heartedly. Why do you say that? What is behind that
claim? There is actually a whole chapter in the book talking about the genetics of it. I mean, it's actually well known. It's just that I think where the confusion is, does stress cause illness? That's where the difference is. So the point I must clarify is stress doesn't make you sick, but it suppresses your immune system. So what happens is, so you normally will have some underlying things which can suddenly take off on you. So for example, these are well known, you know, I'm an academic, so really most of all the research in the book is not only peer-reviewed, published, it's non-controversial. But for example, there's plenty of evidence out there. If you looked at women with breast cancer or something, people who were under stress deteriorated much more than people who weren't, who were more positive. And we know this in other cancers as well. And we can actually, there is a reason, and I'll just explain it briefly too, because like you said, you know, there's a lot of misconception out there. Yeah. See, stress is really a warning mechanism, right? So if you go back and look at, say, 100,000 years ago when modern man came out of Africa, life was very dangerous. So even with all our, you know, terrorism and everything else, we actually live in the safest of times for an individual. So if you look at 100,000 years ago, they were full of predators because man's footprint on our planet was very small. So, you know, there was saber-tooth tigers. You were pretty much killed by predators who ate you up. So the people who were more stressed survived because these were the scaredy cats still in the caves, not going out and fighting the battle, saying, oh no, the tiger's going to get me. You go out there. And, you know, the guys who went out saying, I'll get the tiger, you know, they didn't come back. Right. So the thing you must remember is when, and this is the thing which from a biologist or evolution biologist like me, or when Richard Dawkins said the selfish gene, the reason for it is when we say survival of the fittest, fitness when is defined differently in biology and in by population. So if I ask a person on the street what's fitness, they'll mean physical fitness. But if I ask a biologist what's fitness, it is defined as the ability to propagate a particular gene. So in other words, the people who survived had the fitter genes, and in this case, they were the scaredy cat genes. So that's why, you see?
I'm laughing because we're Jewish, and my brother has this joke that all the people who were in Germany right before World War II, that all the Jews that were like, we're out of here, right? Everybody probably thought they were crazy before the war broke out. But, you know, now the kind of more stressed out ones are the ones that survived.
That's it. So what actually happens is, so this is throughout history. So more of us carry more stress-related genes than we should because they survived. But what happened is, the second thing is, stress in short bursts is actually useful. So that's why adrenaline sports, things like that, they give you a buzz, because in short bursts, stress is good for you. But so what happens in stress is, it's like a fire alarm going off. So it goes off in the system. In the early stages, you have, you know, adrenaline and noradrenaline secreted. And after that, the cortisol, which is a steroid. So in short bursts, steroids are good, you know, as athletes would find out. But in long term, if it's chronically secreted, then your immune system goes down, you gain weight, all these effects of being on steroids for a long time. So if somebody is under constant stressful life, it's automatic that they have low energy, their immune system is suppressed, they're putting on weight, even if they're not eating that much. So all these things are because you're inherent. So it's as unpleasant as, you know, that's why I say it's like a fire alarm or a house burglar alarm. Mm-hmm. It's okay. It's a good warning, but you're not supposed to have it on all the time because it's not healthy for you.
And why is it that we are in constant stress mode if, in fact, whereas I agree with you, right? Like, it is very safe, mainly, right? We're living at homes. That's we're it. Protected from the elements. There's no tiger chasing us in the middle of the night.
That's it.
Why are we in a constant state of flight? What's going on?
And that's what I'm saying. So partly there is a genetic element because of the fact that we know that these genes survived, the scaredy cat genes.
Uh-huh.
But the second problem really is, we haven't trained ourselves. And this is how someone like you, who coaches people, can make a massive difference, because we are seeing scaredy cat, we're seeing tigers where there are no tigers.
Yeah.
You know, you're driving on the road and somebody cuts you, you know, come on, he's not a saber tooth, you know, just chill. There's no need to. You know, I'm astounded as to, you know, people always say, you know, oh, how can you look so young and be fit? It's nothing. You just have to chill a bit. You know, people get too personal about everything. And I really think, because people think everything is about themselves. And it isn't. We play a small part in this world for a limited period of time, irrespective of our beliefs. You see, Judeo, Christian, Islamic all have a version of heaven or hell. Then you're Eastern, Hindu, Buddhist, Shinto, you all have a version of reincarnation. And then you're a greeny atheist and you just get recycled by earthworms. But in all these three, right, this is our only chance. As Laura shared, we're not going to come back in this form again. So, you know, this is our chance to make a difference and leave it a better place. But everyone thinks everything is about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a big part. So when you think it's about themselves, you start taking everything personally. Something goes wrong, you're like, I've got to nail, you know, it's all about you, 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 you. And I think it actually just have to step back and, like I said earlier, apply the three C's of, you know, writing your own story, and then you write a better story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I can't stress enough how much this will change your life. The move to stop taking things as personally. I mean, it's hard some days you do, but if you actually really stop and think in every moment that you're stressed, that it's not personal, it's not about you, that person might be just having a bad day or whatever just happened, you're still safe. You're still okay. You know, you're going to quote unquote survive in the bigger picture. It can change your life, because that sense of stress all the time and the cortisol and right all the chemicals that are being released, what does that do to your body? You said it affects the immune system, but how does it affect it, and what does that do, say, in 5 years if you're living in that state all the time?
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. So it's the same effect as, you know, somebody is on steroids for a long period of time, and typical things are, you know, your skin gets worse for a start, and then you gain weight, you have lower energy, you're more depressed. So it's a vicious cycle, because yeah, you're constantly in it and then you can't get out. And this is something. But the other thing also we must understand is, when we're talking about genes, everything in the world is about a little bit of genetics and a little bit of environment, right? So if you look at anything, so if you take skin cancer, something I work with, there is a bit of genetic element, and the environment is, say, sun damage. And if you look at lung cancer, you know, environment possibly be, you know, is smoking, and then genetics. So the point is, similarly, even for stress, there may be a genetic element, but the environment, when what we eat and drink, also plays a big part. So if somebody is drinking a lot or abusing drugs, automatically you will not help your stress situation. The second thing is, we in the book we talk about studies done, this is again quote unquote, I just took it from the research, they call it American cafeteria diet. I didn't, but it's basically Coke and fast food. And what they found
so
is
bad.
Right, but what they found is, when they put even mice on this and looked at the genetic element, within a week, not only they gained weight, obviously, because of the higher calories, but they started expressing these stressful genes and got more. So you get more depressed and angry if you eat a lot of Coke and fast food, because the high sugar content gives you a high and then it dips. And it competes for the same opiate receptor. So in sometimes, if you're already in that kind of thing, your diet can also play a big part. So, yes. So sometimes if you're eating a lot of junk food, it's hard for you to be a calm person. So I think in some ways, that's the sort of thing I think you got to look at the whole thing as saying, it's all very well trying to make change. But the second thing is, we got to look at the environment. That's both external, and that's how we interact with others, as well as the physical earth environment. And the second thing is our internal one. And that's what we can control, which is what we put into our bodies. And if you step back and think about it, and from that perspective, and like what you're saying, every time you reach a crossroads where there is a major, problem you've got to solve. And like I said, you can just have an algorithm. You can say, hang on for a second. There are only two types of problems in the world, right? Ones which you can control, which means you can do something about it, or ones you can't. And the ones you can do something, typically your job, your relationships, the friends you keep, that kind of stuff. And the stuff which you have no control over are things like what other people want you to do, how somebody who competes with you thinks you should be, or even what you want other family members to do or something. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, the way I look at it is, every time you're in a thing, I have a little mini algorithm in my head. I say, am I in control of this? Which means, can you do something yourself to change it? If it's yes, then do it. So don't whinge about it. But if you can't, then again, don't whinge about it, because you can't do anything anyway. You see?
No, this is like, this goes back all the way to Stoicism. I mean, the philosophy has been there thousands of years. And
that's it.
It's so obvious when you think about the grocer example. If you said, I'm going with, sorry, bad example because you're a skin doctor, but I'm going to go out in the sun today and get some sun, but it's raining. You would never force that idea, if it's pouring rain out, that I'm going to go to the pool and be in the sun today, because it's impossible. But we take other examples, like other people, for example, where we have no influence, and we just push and push and push into situations that we have no control, and it's stressful and miserable for everybody.
That's right.
So I read that in 30 years, you've never missed a day of work from being sick, which is crazy.
Every day I say that, I think that's it. I say I shouldn't have said this. Something's going to strike me down. I was telling this to a friend last week who went to med school with me, and this was in 87, right? So he said, isn't this great? And I said, yes, I haven't lost a single working day because of illness. And he was like, don't tempt fate. And I said, I know I'm going to fall sick tomorrow. But it hasn't happened yet.
What does your regimen look like? What kinds of, what kind of exercise? What do you do? You mentioned a handful of things that have already been so meaningful, not taking things personally, thinking about control. But what would you say in a week are the types of things that you feel are absolutely critical to staying in a healthy space?
I think the thing which I find is different in the choices I've made compared to the choices many of my colleagues have made is that I've really just done things I'm really, really passionate about. So in some ways, it means making unconventional choices, which wouldn't be necessarily the best for your career, because people will think, come on, you don't want to do that. That's not where you're going to make a lot of money or something like that. But I think, so the way I've looked at it in life is, money becomes an accomplishment, not an aim, right? So I do a lot of pro bono work. One day a week, I just take time off and I teach creative writing to children who can't read and write properly, because I'm a writer, so it helps my writing. As you know, when you teach people like you do, it actually helps you as well,
Yeah.
So I think
it's a secret. Don't tell people that.
That's it. So that's it. So there's one day a week, I'm giving up a day. And I, even when I go to the schools, I find it astounding, because this experiment, when it started 20 years ago, showed that it improved math and science. So I ended up on the National Commission of UNESCO, you know, the UN body for education. So for many years I was on UNESCO. So people, when I go to the schools now, people often say, does UNESCO pay you? Because people always are on this thing that you have to, you know, everything is commercial. But I'm like, no, I'm here because I want to be here. And actually, that's the truth. So I teach at two different universities, and I made it clear that I'll do them on my terms, that I'll come and I'll do the lectures, I'll write enough papers to keep my professorship. I'm not going to be a full-time academic because that means I got to live in that world, I got to speak in that world, I can't live my own life. But these are not mainstream choices because there is higher risk in it, because if you're a full-time tenure, then you're taken care of. You can just, you know, clock in, clock out. You can do what you like. You know, you can already retire. But, you know, but that's not fun. So I think the most important thing is you have to find fun in life. That's what, you know, keeps you going. And the one way you'll find fun is not only that you do what you love, but you love what you do. So if you're getting up every day and thinking, oh my God, I got to go to job, I wish it was a weekend. If you wish every day was a weekend, then you probably should be doing some other job.
100%, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. And thinking,
that's it. That's what I'm saying. There's nothing wrong.
Change. It's so overwhelming though to step into the unknown. So many people stick with it, but it just, that feeling will never go away, that heaviness and that weight. And so you make a comment too that medicine is not health. And I personally love this, having had a healthcare company. The thing I was really struck by was that medicine, especially in America, to me is a crisis intervention point. You're already deep into illness by the time you get to the medical system. Is that what that means? What is it that?
Yeah, it's basically the best analogy. So after I'm full of useless information, partly because after I did medicine, I studied law, philosophy, and ethics. So, you know, you get all these useless sort of things which are not practical. Everyone thinks, why are you studying that? But, you know, you just broaden your horizons. So after I did law and medicine, what I realized is they're very, very similar because they're very old-fashioned guilds. They got lots of rules and regulations. You got a member of a college or member of the bar. They're all the sort of same. And, you know, at the top, dogs in both, you know, very expensive surgeon or expensive lawyer pretty much behave the same. They, you know, they always try to be like their pack of wolves mentality. Let's get the other guys, that kind of stuff. But what I found is that law doesn't always translate to justice, because if you know somebody is stabbed right in front of you, but he wasn't read his rights properly, he's going to get off wherever you are in the world. So you think, this is crazy, but he actually did it. And it's the same thing in medicine. Is medicine is an industry, so we can only prescribe if you have an illness. We can only sell you medications if you have an illness. We can only do something on you if you're sick. So why would we be interested in keeping you healthy? You know, it's counterintuitive. But so that's what I say in the book is, for some reason, people assume law is about justice. Law is not about justice, just like medicine isn't about health. So how you can make medicine about health is, you take personal responsibility. So like we said, you know, with or without a gene test, a lot of basic things you can do: eat in moderation, avoid processed food, keep yourself physically fit, maintain an ideal weight, and have fun. So, you know, and give to other people. So there's plenty of evidence to show. Actually, speaking of generosity, there's actually a gene for generosity called AVPR1. And some people, and like I said, sometimes the same gene does two different things. So some people are naturally more generous and some people are naturally more ungenerous. But having said that, even the ungenerous ones, once they start giving, their health improves. And there are plenty of studies on it.
So people are naturally more and less giving.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know it, you know, when you look around, you know some guys.
I just thought that, but I thought that was like experience or family or something.
But all those things shape your genes. That's what I'm trying to say. So you see, you can also, and they don't lead to better health, both mental and physical. So, you know, somebody who's really a bad human being as an ungenerous, you rarely see them perfect specimens. There's something wrong somewhere. So I think the real thing we've got to understand is, so the last chapter in the book is called Eat, Move, Give. So eating is, you know, eat sensibly, and essentially means avoid processed food. And, you know, if you want to take it to the next level, and that's where gene tests and things come in, then move. You know, movement is so important because the brain evolved for movement. So we know that the less we move, we increase the risk of dementia, increase the risk of depression, increase all this kind of thing. So movement is so important, especially movement for movement's sake. So when I was researching this book, I thought I'd be writing more about yoga and Tai Chi and all that, you know, because it's become a lot more trendy in recent times. But the funny thing is, you know, the best exercise form to reduce dementia and improve Parkinson's disease was the tango, dancing the tango.
I'm a yoga person. That kind of upset me.
I mean, yoga is very good for, you see, but yoga particularly, like I said, is very good for stress relaxation. So if you are seeing saber-toothed tigers everywhere, by all means do yoga, you know. But if you want to reduce your risk of dementia or you've got a family with Parkinson's, dance the tango. Because the thing with it is, A, you have a partner. See, yoga, you can do in isolation as well. See, having a partner is good. And then you can have, and you can be in a room full of people. But fundamentally, yoga is like golf. You compete against yourself.
Yes.
Yes, right. So what it is with tango is you will hooked on to someone else, so you've got to go with them. And then you learn to adapt. And it's movement for movement's sake. So tango is very good. And I found bizarrely, even things where there was leg movement was very important. So if you looked at things, constant leg movement for endurance, like, you know, Celtic dancing. Like I was in, this is a funny story, because I was in Dublin at the Dalkey Book Festival in June this year, talking about this book. And there was an American connection because they had Bernie Sanders on the same festival. And of course, I thought that's great because Bernie will get the crowds and I'll sell some books collaterally. I didn't think it happened like that. But anyway, so I said, I researched Celtic dancing. And guess what? If you move your legs up and down, you know, the ridiculous dance, the river dance. Yeah, I thought it was ridiculous, but it reduces the risk of dementia. So I said to them in Ireland, I said, listen, we guys can finally forgive you guys for river dance, you know, for inflicting river dance upon the world. We finally.
That's hilarious. That is so funny. Well, so I ask everybody who comes on the show as a final question, I want to ask you as well, what does an authentic life mean to you?
I think an authentic life is reading your own story and finding it is true. So as a writer, I think finding your own voice would be the one line summary, because what I think is every time, as with anything, when you start off in life, you copy other people because you think, as in writing, you think, hey, you know, that guy is good, that guy is cool, I want to be like him or her. But after a while, you realize that you are not him or her because you have your own voice and you have your own style and you have your own, you know, things which drive you. And I think it's not that easy to find unless you let yourself find it. And most people live somebody else's lives because they want to be accepted by society and what they think. And, you know, sorry, it was a little long-winded answer, but one of the things is when I teach writing, it's the same thing. When people say they have the writer's block and I say that's laziness, largely because you are already seeing your book on a bookshelf or you're thinking the reader's not going to like it. Forget about them. Write for yourself. And that's what authenticity is about. Live life for yourself. Mm. If you look inside yourself and you find your own story, something you're proud of, something you're happy of, something you're relaxed about, then automatically it means you'll be healthy and happy. If you look inside yourself and you know yourself that you're living somebody else's life just because you want more followers or whatever, then it isn't your life and you're not going to be completely happy.
I love that answer. It must be because I went to philosophy school as well. We must be kindred spirits on this. But beautiful, beautiful. I love that answer. Write your own story, live your own story. And when you have your own voice and you are living from that truth, everything takes on a sense of ease. Well, thank you so much for joining us. If people are interested in finding more about you, we will have it on the website. But if you could just share quickly, where is the best place to find you?
Yeah, it's just Sharad, Sharad, Paul, Paul.com, or you can just do geneticsofhealth.com and then you'll find me.
Well, thank you so much for sharing interesting, philosophically deep, but also practical advice with the audience today. And I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, Laura. Go well. Thank you very much.